Thank you, Ed and Dave and all the other organizers. If those are. Yes, you can. It's great to be here in this beautiful town and great institute. So I am going to start with the transparencies because I am going to review stuff which I believe has been covered fairly extensively in the early part of the conference before I got here. So is this in focus? Thing I'll have to do. I'll remind you about the setup of the geometric Lyon lens conjecture, which means I'll have to talk a little bit about Lie algebra stuff, roots and characters and weights, moduli spaces of bundles and local systems, derived categories, Hecke correspondences and Hecke operators, stacks, germs, and some examples. So that's going to go by very quickly because I assume that you all know what the geometric Lyon lens conjecture is one day before the end of this conference.
Is there going to be a quiz?
Yes. Written test. The approach that I'm talking about is based on abelianization. So I'll talk about Higgs bundles and the Hitchin system, speckler covers and Kamel covers. I want to explain a very old approach to trying to use this abelianization to understand the geometric Lyon lens conjecture. And this led to a fairly recent result with Tony Pantev on the duality of the Hitchin system, duality between Higgs for a group G and its Lyon lens dual group. So that will be the content of the third part. I'll give the definition, state the conjecture, explain what our theorem is, and maybe outline the proof, depending on time. The rest of the talk, and where I drop out of the transparencies, is going to be on the connection to non-abelian Hodge. So I'll basically review the non-abelian Hodge theory. I want to sort of outline how that fits in with what we're doing, and I want to explain some compatibility results. The outcome of that is going to be that you really need to focus your effort on understanding a certain collection of loci in moduli space, the wobbly loci. So I will finish with some examples and illustrations of how that works. So again, maybe that went by a little fast. This is based on a paper from a couple of years ago with Tony Pantev and on some work in progress with Simpson and a lot of work in progress with Tony. So, right. So the geometric Lyon lens conjecture says that there exists a natural equivalence of categories between two bounded derived categories. One is on Loc and the other is on Bunn. There's an L on Bunn indicating that you replace a group by its Lyon lens dual group. The thing on the left is the derived category of coherent sheaves. The one on the right is the derived category of D-modules. So there should exist a natural equivalence of categories sending structure sheaves of points on the left to automorphic D-modules on the right. And that green box tells you what it means to be an automorphic D-module. It basically means that there is something that operates here. It's those H's. So H stands for Hecke operator. I'll explain those momentarily. And the point is that if you start with something on the left, which is the structure sheaf of just one point, so you pick a local system, take its structure sheaf, take this correspondence C, move it over to the D module world, you should get an eigen object. That means something which, when you apply the Hecke to it, you get itself tensored with some associated local system of the given one. So the notation is C is a curve, G is a reductive group, T its maximal torus. When I do my best approximation of Gothic letters, that means the Lie algebras. And when I put a super left script, L, that means Langlands dual group, Langlands dual torus, and so on. So the basic picture is right here. Is there a stick or a pointer or anything? There's a laser pointer? Oh, fantastic. Thank you. Yeah. So given the group G, there are three lattices, roots, characters, and weights. The two extreme ones, the roots and weights, depend only on the Lie algebra. The one in the middle characterizes the group among all the isogenous groups with the given Lie algebra. So characters means homomorphisms from the maximal torus T to C star. And roots are the smallest characters, the characters for the adjoint form of the group, and weights would be for the simply connected one. Then you have the dual lattices. So the dual of roots we call, the dual of weights we call co-roots. The dual of roots we call co-weights, and dual of characters are co-characters. And a definition of the Langlands dual group and Langlands dual algebra is that it's the algebra and the group whose characters are the co-characters, roots are co-roots, and so on. Because that's a lousy definition. Why does it exist? Why is it unique? And so on. But it turns out you really can construct it, and it is more or less functorially unique. Not quite functorially. Maybe functorially. Anyway, it's there. Bun will be the moduli space of semi-stable principal G bundles on the curve. Bun with the superscript L will be the same thing with the Langlands dual group for structure group. Similarly, Loc is the moduli space of semi-stable G local systems, or equivalently, vector bundles with a flat connection on the curve. And Loc L is the same for the dual group. And in addition, I have the whole shebang with script letters or calligraphic letters, and that would be the corresponding moduli stack instead of the space. No, I don't want that. The Hecke correspondence driving this, it is a correspondence. A correspondence between two varieties is a subvariety of the product, and it's supposed to operate by pulling back and pushing forward. So it's something between a pullback and a direct image. Explicitly, or set theoretically, moduli space of quadruples V, V prime, X, and beta is the Hecke correspondence. So V and V prime are principal bundles with one of the groups, let's say GL, on the curve. X is a point of the curve. And beta is an isomorphism between those two bundles away from the point, allowed to blow up arbitrarily at the point. So this Hecke is something which maps to Bun and to Bun cross C. V lives here, V prime here, X here. Hecke is a set of betas that give you isomorphism between such. The good thing is that this is nice and group theoretic and smooth and all that. The bad thing is that it's infinite dimensional. So it's really, I say down here somewhere, these are all in schemes. The fibers of P and Q are in schemes. If you prefer to work with projective geometry, you want finite dimensional object, you have to slice the whole thing. So it turns out what you want to do is fix a co-character, mu. So let first lambda be a positive character of the Langlands dual group. That's the same as a positive co-character of the group, or a dominant character. That gives you a representation, rho sub lambda, an irreducible representation of the Langlands dual group with highest weight equal to lambda. Mu lives in the dual lattice. So where lambda was a character, mu was a co-character of one group, or vice versa for the other group. Then the way you slice it is you say that Hecke at cutoff at mu is a set of those v, v prime, x, and beta, such that for every lambda, right, so we're fixing mu, the condition is that for every lambda with corresponding representation rho sub lambda, the induced isomorphism of vector bundles, so rho beta is an isomorphism from the vector bundle rho v to the vector bundle rho of v prime, should have poles of some bounded order. It should have poles on C, only at the point X, and the multiplicity is at most the inner product of mu and lambda. Remember, mu and lambda live in dual lattices, so their pairing is an integer. That is the integer that bounds the cutoff. So that's how you convert this in-scheme Hecke into a collection of projective objects, Hecke mu, indexed by the characters of G, the dominant characters of G, or the dominant co-characters of the Langlands dual group. Okay, so this is slightly technical, but it's just, you just have to say it to get a reasonable statement of the problem. So the fibers are in schemes, namely they are affine Grassmannians, and the slices give you finite dimensional closed subschemes of those, but they tend to be very singular. In fact, one of these is smooth if and only if mu is a minuscule weight. So for SLN or GLN, you have a few of those. For other groups, you have none whatsoever. So in general, you have to deal with these singularities. The Hecke operator, as I already said, is what you get by combining a pullback and a direct image to this Hecke correspondence. So it's an integral transform, let's say, from the derived category to the derived category. You go from Bern to Bern cross the curve. And what you do is you take an object down on Bern, call it M. You pull it back, let's say, by the projection at some finite level mu. So it's now on Hecke mu. You push it down the other way. So you've gone from Bern to Hecke down to Bern cross C. You got something on Bern cross C. If Hecke happens to be smooth, if this version of Hecke happens to be smooth, then that's all you need to do. If Hecke has singularities, it turns out you have to compensate for them by sticking in here the intersection chain complex for it. So it just, you just tensor with the local system Z, the integers, if everything is smooth. Otherwise, you have to take care of the singularities, and that turns out to be the right way. So this is the operator induced by the Hecke correspondence. Or you can just fix a point of X, and then it just goes from bun to bun, just restrict to any given point of X of the curve. All of these give you a Hecke algebra of operators generated by H mu X for all points of the curve and all levels mu. And a nice little exercise is to see that this is abelian, so that you can try to diagonalize the algebra. Actually, it's trivial to see that as long as you're taking two operators with different supported at different points X. It's kind of obvious that if you modify your vector bundle at one point and modify it at the other point, or do it in the other order, it doesn't matter. And by continuity, you see that they have to commute even when X equals X prime. So now I think I've explained everything that went into the original statement. There's a slight discrepancy, which is that one of our objects, this L-Bern, can be disconnected. A group of connected components is H2 of the curves, is pi coefficients in pi 1 of the group, which ends up being the Poitier-Eigen dual of the center of G. Its size is the same as the size of the center of G. So if G is SLN, the center has N elements in it. So it has N connected components. So the derived category of the modules on it will decompose into the like sum or whatever product of derived categories of the components. On the other hand, lock is irreducible because your local systems are all topologically trivial. There is no topological way to distinguish different local systems. So it follows that the derived category of lock is, again, indecomposable. So it's going to be hard to make an indecomposable thing isomorphic to one that's not. So there are various ways of fixing that, and probably the best way is to replace lock by the stack lock. So it's the moduli stack of semi-stable geolocal systems, or you can even take the moduli stack of all geolocal systems. And then you have to think about what that all means, and I'm not going to do that today. But basically, it's an algebraic stack whose coarse moduli space is the underlying previous space, and there exists some open substack where the regularly stable objects which give you a banded gerb whose structure group is just the center of G. So the point is that from this gerby description, you see that the derived category of the stack actually has components, and they are given exactly by the same thing, by the dual of the center of the group. So that exactly compensates for the components of the other one. So that's one way to fix it. This causes an asymmetry. If you look very carefully at what I put up here, you might have noticed that I have bun with straight font while lock is in calligraphic. So in the version that I stated, there really is this asymmetry. There is a better version which takes the calligraphic thing here, but then you have to fix it. So there is a slightly jazzier version of Langlands that looks more symmetric. And the thing that I'll talk about actually includes that the gerbiness and the stackiness on both sides. Ah, thank you. So the one example that can really be understood is GL1. But let's start with GLN. If G is GLN, its Langlands dual turns out to be the same. The local system is just a rank n local system on the curve. The Hecke algebra in this case is generated by the HIs, right? So in general, we needed Hecke mu for every dominant mu. So that the simple roots, just the exterior product of the standard representation generate the cone of dominant weights, and in this case, the whole Hecke algebra. So we have generators which happen to all be minuscule. So in this case, we can pretty much avoid all the issues of the singularities, because you can reduce the question of having simultaneous eigenobjects for the whole Hecke algebra to having Hecke eigenobjects just for a finite collection of n smooth things, so you can avoid the intersection chains in that case. And in that case, the fiber is just going to be the Grassmannian for i-dimensional spaces in a fixed n-dimensional vector space. So things simplify quite a bit for GLN. They simplify a lot more for GL1, because Bunn is then just a Picard variety. The Hecke correspondence now goes from C across the Picard to the Picard, and it has a shift of 1 in the degree, and it is just the Abel-Jacobi map. A point X and a line bundle L goes to L tensored with O of X. For the local system, so we're dealing with a line bundle and of degree 0 and a flat connection. And then what is the Langlands correspondence in that case? It just takes it to the unique local system on the Picard, which restricts to this local system or the curve. And topologically, this is just the fact that pi 1 of the Picard, or the connected component of the Picard, is the abelianization of pi 1 of the curve. So any local system on the curve with values in GL1, which is abelian, has to factor through pi 1 of the Jacobian. And there is a pretty algebraic geometric argument, I think is due to Deligne, that that works in any characteristic and so on using symmetric products. Someone might have actually done it here in the first week, I'm not sure. Anyway, that was my quick introduction to the question. I'm going to be working with Higgs bundles. So a Higgs bundle with values in G on the curve C is a pair of V phi. Well, V is a vector bundle or principal G bundle. And phi, well, if V is a vector bundle, phi goes from V to V tensor omega C. In general, phi will be a global section of the adjoint vector bundle of V tensored with the canonical bundle of C. The Hitchin map is a map from the Higgs moduli space, Higgs CG, to a vector space, the Hitchin base, B CG. There are various ways of describing it. The way you usually see in the literature is that it's the sum, I going from 1 to the rank, the dimension of the maximal torus, of global sections of certain powers of the canonical bundle. Those powers are the degrees of the invariant polynomials. The way I prefer to think about it is you take the canonical bundle, you tensor it with the Cartan-Sub algebra. So you have a vector bundle over the curve. You divide it by the action of W. It acts only on T. So it's a bundle of things. By Chevalier's theorem, those things are isomorphic to vector spaces, but it's not quite canonically isomorphic. So it's a bundle of vector spaces, but the structure group is not GLN. It acts a little non-linearly. So there's something slightly confusing about that. But nevertheless, it's just a topological or algebraic fiber bundle over the curve, and you take its global sections. That is the Hitchin base. And in that and you can see that this works out. It's an elementary exercise. And then given a Higgs bundle, V and phi, you send it to the point in the base, which is basically phi mod W at each point. And then in this language, it's just you evaluate the invariant polynomials on phi, and you get a bunch of pluricanonical differentials. There's also a spectral cover, or the version I prefer, the cameral cover. So over the curve across the base, there is a universal thing, which is a family of curves. I'll call it script C tilde. Over a point little b in B, the fiber is the spectral cover, the cameral cover C sub B. Here's how you describe it. There's a map from C cross B to the total space of this bundle, right? Remember, B came from global sections of that. So there's an evaluation map given a global section and a point to a point of the total space. This space is a bundle of quotients over the curve. It has a Galois cover with Galois group W, which is just the total space where you don't mod out by W. So this thing has a cover. This thing maps to it. Pull back. You get an induced Galois cover of C cross B. And when you restrict to each point in the base, that gives you a Galois cover of the curve. That is the Camel cover. The usual spectral covers are just quotients of that by various finite subgroups. The abelianization result, Hitchin's theorem essentially, is that the fiber over any point of the base is an abelian variety, which can be described as some prims, so some quotient of abelian varieties. It's some abelian variety you make out of the spectral curve, Camel curve, divided by the Jacobian of C, basically. In other words, this Hitchin map is an integrable system. The other crucial ingredient is that it contains a cotangent to Born as a Zariski open subset. Somehow the essence of what I'm talking about today is going to be the difference between those. So why is there a difference? Because of the stability conditions. A Higgs bundle can be stable where the underlying vector bundle is unstable. So you can have an unstable bundle such that when you add the Higgs field to it, the pair is stable. So you have more Higgs bundles than just cotangents to stable bundles. Anyway, for every co-character mu, we have associated spectral cover, which is the appropriate quotient of this Galois cover. I won't get into that, but just in the case of GLN, the Camel cover has degree n factorial. The usual spectral cover has just degree n. It's the obvious quotient. The formal result that I find most useful is from a paper of mine with Dennis Geitzgory. It says that this universal Camel cover determines an abelian group scheme T over C cross B, and the Hitchin map or the Higgs space is a principal homogeneous stack over this abelian group scheme of T torsors, and you can say exactly which gerb you get that controls this torsor structure. So this is the cleanest formal version of this abelianization. The rough version is just what it says here, that the fibers of the Hitchin map are prim varieties, and of course there's a long list of people who have proved the results along direction. So back in 87, there was a celebratory issue of the of Duke, dedicated to some round birthday or another of Manin. And I ran into Arnaud Beauville, and he told me he's working on this nice little paper with Narasimhan and Ramanand, where they're doing something with Hitchin's system. And have a look. Hitchin has a nice paper in this Duke journal. So I looked there, but I kind of opened it to a different page. The next paper was one by LeMond, where he was talking about geometric Langlands. So I read both of them, and then I was tossing it out. It seemed like they were talking about the same thing. And ever since then, I've been pretty fascinated by the connection between the Hitchin system and the geometric version of the Langlands conjecture. So pretty soon after that, I developed this stuff, which seemed pretty useless at the time. So what is this stuff? It says that you can abelianize the Hecke operators. You know, create Hecke operators that act not on bundles, but on Higgs bundles. And you can actually write down explicitly eigensheaves or eigenobjects for these abelianized Hecke operators. So let me just go through it. This is a picture we already had. Script C is the universal camera cover over C cross H in base. And it's, this part we had. What I'm now doing is something slightly devious. I'm saying, fix a vector bundle V. Look at the fiber of the Hitchin map over that. So the cotangent bundle, cotangent space at V to bun. But it's a vector space which maps to B. The map is finite to 1. Not it's nonlinear. It's finite to 1. It has some big degree. The degree is the degree of the Hitchin map. And I'm saying, take the fiber product. So that's some family of spectral covers. Every spectral cover is in there, but not once, rather this capital N time, the degree of the Hitchin map. C bar is the universal camel cover. You can think of it as the universal spectral cover. It's that's right. So for each point of the base, it's just a cover of C. I fit them all together, but I take each of them not once, but finite number. I'm just taking a branch cover of the base determined by a bundle V, and taking this fiber product. So what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to start with a local system on the curve that gives me a line bundle L on each spectral cover or each camel cover, such that its direct image or something that's induced from it is V shifted by something having to do with ramification. So this is the abelianization. It tells you that on each spectral cover, you can get such line bundles that pull back, that push forward to this V. The connection nabla induces a holomorphic connection on the line bundle L. Well, it induces a meromorphic connection if you don't stick the canonical bundle here. And the point of twisting out the ramification is you get rid of the growth in decrement and rock shift. You get rid of the poles that come from the ramification. Right? If you just have a vector bundle, which is a direct image of a line bundle, then at ramification points, a connection downstairs pulls back to a meromorphic connection upstairs. It turns out that there's a canonical way of untwisting that and getting another connection upstairs that's actually everywhere regular, but on a bundle which has to be twisted by a power of the canonical bundle.
So the connection number is
No, this is elementary. I'm just saying you have... is this visible? Not really. Here is the cover of the base, except sometimes it looks like this. It's ramified. Okay? So at the point here, your V is a vector bundle of rank 3, whose fiber at the point here is just a sum of 3 fibers coming from these points. If you have a connection here, you pull back, you get a connection on each... It will have poles at this point. Right? What I'm saying is there is a global way of changing this line bundle by a power of the canonical bundle and getting a new connection on that which is regular everywhere, including those ramification points. And I think I actually give you the formula here. So the point is that it depends, it's canonical up to the choice of a square root of the canonical bundle. You use the fact that the ramification divisor is the pullback of some power of the canonical bundle. And that says that Okay, so the natural induced connection has residue half at each ramification point, but then modify it by adding half d log of a function, where this is some function whose poles, let's say, are the ramification and whose zeros are on the pullback of the canonical divisor. So that's a way of undoing all the ramification, getting a holomorphic connection. It will be flat. It will be flat, a flat holomorphic connection, yeah. Because it's a curve, exactly. If you put it in a family, on the family, it will not be flat. It'll have curvature where the Jacobians will be Lagrangian subvarieties for it. Anyway, so the idea is you start with this integrable, with this flat connection on a vector bundle. You convert the vector bundle in C to a family of line bundles with flat connections on the speckle covers. You use the GL1 case, which I just explained, to spread each of those on the Jacobians. So you go from C tilde, or C bar, to the relative Picard, or the family of prims, and that is basically the Higgs bundle. So you get this way a bundle with a connection which is flat along the fibers on Higgs. Well, it's Higgs tilde, which really means it's this finite cover of Higgs given by the pulling back by this map. This is what I was doing in the green box. So you're getting a finite cover of Higgs in a line bundle with a connection on that. Push it down to Higgs, and you get a vector bundle on Higgs whose rank is the degree of the Hitchin map. And on it, you get, a local system along fibers over the base. So if you want an explicit formula, the fiber of this object, this automorphic object at a pair E psi, is the sum of lines. The sum is over all those phis. So psi is a Higgs field on E. Phi is any Higgs field on V where the Hitchin map identifies the two of them. So slightly counterintuitive, but turns out you can get a line here. This is just the fiber. This inner product, some sort of a delinear product, it's the fiber of the Poincaré bundle at the point corresponding to L and M. Anyway, there's some explicit formula. It gives you an object, and the point is that this object is an eigensheaf for these abelianized Hecke. So the Hecke operators are induced from the Hecke correspondences between Bunn and Bunn cross C. The abelianized Hecke correspondences are correspondences between Higgs and Higgs cross C. Explicitly, Hecke consisted of quadruples, V, V prime, X, and beta. V and V prime are two bundles, and beta is an isomorphism away from the point X. The abelianized version consists of bigger tuples. V phi is one Higgs bundle. V prime phi prime is another. X is a point. Beta is the same isomorphism we had before between V and V prime away from X. But you want it to commute with the Higgs field. So the Higgs field goes from V to V tensor omega. Beta tensor identity goes from V to V prime, both tensors of the canonical bundle, and you want this diagram to commute.
Now called
it's called what?
Toft.
So nowadays these are called Toft operators. I can't quite pronounce that name, but Toft operators. Thank you. Right. The point is that the fiber of this is the Grassmannian, five-dimensional spaces in an n-dimensional space, in the case of GLN, or some flag variety, generalized flag variety in general. The fiber here is a finite collection of eigenspaces of phi x. Right? Saying that it commutes says that you only get to modify along a subspace which is an eigenspace, or a sum of eigenspaces, an invariant subspace under phi. So there's only a finite number of those. So where V tilde, the end of the story is that the V tilde that I constructed in the previous slide does have an automorphic property, but with respect to Hecke tilde, not with respect to Hecke. Okay, so what do you do with it? Well, back then I spent a long time trying to somehow get out of that a Hecke eigensheaf, and it didn't work. There are several ways you could do it. One way, which I was trying, was to somehow average or integrate over all possible phis to get from Higgs down to Bunn. It didn't work, so don't worry about it. Another possibility is to start with that and deform it. So you think of this as some sort of a classical limit of Langlands, and then you want to see, can you prove that it deforms nicely? Well, I'm not going to talk about that, but stay tuned till tomorrow. I believe Dima Rinkin is going to talk exactly about that approach. So there's a way of viewing this as a classical limit, and there is a deformation, and there's some reasonable hope that you can actually follow that deformation and try to, at least to first order, produce solutions of Langlands that way. And the third way was to use Simpson's non-abelian Hodge theory, and that is the one that I'm going to focus on today. But first, let me just say a few words about what's the theorem that we have. And I see that I'm not going to do any of the proof. Okay. So the classical limit involves taking some lambda to zero or infinity. There's the notion of lambda connection. I hope everybody knows what that is. Connection is an operator which, when you multiply by f, satisfies Leibniz. And a lambda connection is the same thing where the differentiation part gets multiplied by lambda. So when lambda equals 1, it's just a connection. When lambda is non-zero, it's an equivalent notion to a connection. But when lambda equals 0, it becomes exactly a Higgs field. You get rid of this part. You just want an operator that's F-linear. So it's just a Higgs field. Simpson's result says that this is a diffeomorphism. I should say Corlett and Simpson and maybe some other people say that this process amounts to a diffeomorphism as lambda goes to zero. So this gives a diffeomorphism between Locke and Higgs. So all the fibers are isomorphic. At one, you get local systems. At zero, you get Higgs bunnies. As lambda goes to zero, you can also say the D modules specialize to modules over the symmetric algebra of the tangent bundle, and those are basically coherent sheaves on the cotangent bundle of X. So you get very roughly that the classical limit of the geometric Langlands conjecture is that the boundary-derived category of coherent sheaves on, let's say, the connected component of the Higgs stack should be the same as the boundary-derived category of coherent sheaves on Higgs for the dual group. So what happened? On one side, we took the D modules and converted them to symmetric products, which meant bundles sheaves on Higgs. On the other side, we took the space itself and degenerated from connections to Higgs. So these are two very different kinds of degenerations. And on one side, we're degenerating the space. On the other side, we're degenerating the notion of a function or the kind of sheaves that we're taking. So again, you'll hear a lot more about that from Rinkin, especially the hard part is to understand what happens in this limit to the intersection cohomology sheaf. So the classical limit conjecture is that there is as suggested by that, is that there's a natural equivalence of categories between DB Higgs and DB L Higgs. So you see what I did here was I generalized a little bit. I put the stack on both sides. The previous result had the space on one side and the connected component on the other. But may as well just conjecture the full thing. So DB Higgs should be equivalent to DB of L Higgs. And this correspondence should induce an equivalence where you take the connected component here and the straight space here, and this is the classical limit of Langlands. So this is a slight generalization of the classical limit of Langlands as stated in the beginning. So the C0 should send structure sheaves of points to Hecke eigensheaves. So this is pretty much what Tony and I proved. We proved it only over a Zariski-open subset of the base where the Hamel covers are non-singular. Delta is the discriminant. It parameterizes singular Hamel covers. We work over the complement. So the underlying geometric statement is that the two spaces, Higgs and Higgs for the Langlands dual group, are actually dual integrable systems. The fiber of one is an abelian variety. The fiber of the other is going to be the dual abelian variety in the sense of Mumford and so on. So a number of cases of this, of course, have been known before. Hausel and Thaddeus dealt with the case of GLN and SLN. GLN is self-dual. SLN has dual PGLN. After our work, Hitchin thought that what we were doing was too abstract, and he wanted to see it explicitly, so he worked it out explicitly in the case of G2. And then there is some further information about what happens along the diagonal by Arinkin. Of course, Ngo used similar ideas in his proof of the fundamental lemma. But I'm not going to talk about that because I'm running out of time. So I'm just going to flash a few pages by you. This is just going to be very impressionistic. This was supposed to be the proof of the theorem, but it doesn't seem like I should do that. Pardon? Yeah. But just read the boxes. The first step is you want to show the duality along the base. In other words, there's an isomorphism between the base of the Hitchin system for G and the base of the Hitchin system for the Langlands dual group, which takes the discriminant of one to the discriminant of the other. So it makes sense to say that the two systems are equivalent away from the discriminant. And this isomorphism lifts to an equivalence of the Kamel covers. So the Kamel covers for one group are isomorphic, fiber by fiber, to Kamel covers of the other. But this isomorphism is slightly not obvious in the sense that it interchanges long and short roots. So for the self-dual algebras, you can interpret it as a map from the base to itself, but that map may not be the identity. It's the identity for simply connected groups. It's not the identity for types F and G because it switches short and long roots. So it says that the Kamel cover over one point of the Hitchin base for this group is isomorphic to the Kamel cover over another point after this interchange.
And
you can't say it because these are different spaces. You don't have any way of comparing them.
But yeah, I see. But
for everything other than B and C, you're actually having two systems over the same base. So I can do the comparison.
You do have to interpret the base as the sum of spaces of powers of the canonical bundle, right?
So well, there is an interpretation, and under that interpretation, of course, I'm saying that the two are isomorphic and the discriminants go to each other.
So my other question, in the F and G case, is it true that the identity does not lift to an isomorphism on the Kamel cover?
Yes. Yeah, this is, I believe, the only way to lift it. Anyway, so you need to check the duality along the base. The harder part is to check that the duality lifts the fibers, and basically you use the explicit recipe that Dennis Gajskori and I give, and you work through it. Let me just point out that, I guess unfortunately, our argument is non-algebraic. We don't know how to prove it algebraically. We end up using Hodge theory with real coefficients, so we end up doing some bit that I won't try to get it. Like I said, that was going to be impressionistic. So let's turn this off now. Thank you. And let me pull this up. Is there more chalk? Thank you. Okay, so so as I said, the results of Corlett and Simpson say that if M is a compact Kähler manifold, then you can look at Higgs bundles on M, and you can look at local systems on M with the same structure for both sides. they say that there is a bijection or a diffeomorphism between this and the connected component of that. So a Higgs bundle can have, you can have Higgs bundles on Higgs fields on bundles that are topologically non-trivial. The local systems have to be topological trivial. So I have to take the connected component on one side. This is a diffeomorphism, and that is essentially the non-abelian Hodge theorem in this in the compact case. What I need is the non-compact. So already Simpson, 20 years ago, had a result saying that this is okay for the case that M is a curve in dimension 1. Okay means you can modify your definition so that it works. The key notion that you need is you need to look at parabolic bundles. Parabolic Higgs bundles and parabolic local systems and so on. So what is a parabolic bundle? It's a bundle with a filtration satisfying some periodicity conditions, never mind. A Higgs bundle is a bundle with this filtration and a Higgs field that's somehow compatible with the filtration, and similarly for a D module or a local system. So let me just summarize very briefly by a little table Simpson's result. He says that there is an equivalence between a vector bundle V with a Higgs bundle with a Higgs field theta and another vector bundle V with a flat connection nabla. This is his correspondence. We're on a curve where there are a finite number of points where we allow things to blow up. So you can think of it as a non-compact curve or a compact curve where your objects have this parabolic structure. The data you need to specify includes a jump and an eigenvalue. So in this case, it's in the Higgs case, your Higgs field will be meromorphic at those points. So the eigenvalue is the eigenvalue of the residue of the Higgs field. So you can, let's write that as B plus CI. And then the jump occurs at some real number, let's call it A. Actually, there's a, if you're dealing with a rank R group, there would be R of these triples. So A, B, and C, each of them occurs R times. In the case of GLN, there will be a full flag, so there will be N jumps, and each of them corresponds to one eigenvalue of the... So you really have here something in the Cartan. So you have N R complex numbers. And Simpson calculates that this corresponds to a connection where, again, you have to put a parabolic structure. The eigenvalues in this case are the eigenvalues of the monodromy around the point. So you have a non-trivial structure at the point. The eigenvalues become something like A plus 2CI, if I copy this correctly, while the jump moves to A minus 2B. So there's some linear permutation going on among these values of the jump and the in the pole. So Philip Bolch extended this to smooth divisors on in all dimensions. Pardon? Oh, I'm so sorry. Is that better? My apology. I know you have the joint paper on the wild case. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, I stand corrected. So Picard proves that in all dimension, in the case that the divisor D is smooth, unfortunately that's not good enough. We need to allow divisors with normal crossings. So many people have worked on that. The best results, as far as I can tell, are due to Mochizuki. He looks at normal crossing divisors. And basically proves that there is an analog of this correspondence preserving this behavior of the jumps and the poles. There are some conditions that you have to impose. The two most important conditions are that the thing has to be locally abelian, and you have to define it. But roughly that means that even though you're allowing vector bundle behavior that explodes at some along a divisor, you want to say that this behavior is a direct sum of one-dimensional behaviors. So your vector bundle should look like a direct sum of parabolic line bundles. And that pretty much forces the correct definition of locally abelian. And the main constraint is that the first two Chern classes have to vanish. That takes care of the zero on the side. That's a correct analog of that. Where these are parabolic Chern classes. And then there are various related results by Sabah and many other people. There's a different line of development by Yost, Kang, and Zuo. Like I said, there are many people have been working on this. There is an issue of the functoriality of this correspondence. It's clear on the direct sum, etc., that everything behaves reasonably. It's also fairly clear under pullback. It's more mysterious what happens for direct images. So the work that I am doing or was doing with Carlos Simpson is an attempt to give some large class of situations where we can say that that this non-abelian equivalence respects direct images. There are some things that happen there that are non-obvious. Even for a curve or for a simple orientation, if you have a map that sends z to z to the n, and you have a bundle here with alpha with a, b, c as the invariants, what do you get as the invariants down here? Well, the rank gets multiplied by n. Turns out that the right answer is a over n, b over n, and c over n. B and c live in the Cartan. A lives in the maximal torus. So dividing by n is a multi-valued operation. You have to take all the values, and that turns out to be the right operation. So this part is still a little bit in flux, but hopefully that works. Let me just give the big picture for how this is supposed to connect to Langlands. So in the application, we take M, the space on which this works, to be bun. And let's also consider M tilde, which is Higgs. We'll work with both of them, which is roughly the same as the cotangent of bun, but as I said, it's a little bigger. H inside M cross M is the Hecke correspondence. And let's say H tilde in M tilde cross M tilde is the abelianized Hecke. So let me shoot that up. So I have the following equivalence. I'll do it in three steps. Sheaves on M tilde, whose support is finite over M, correspond to Higgs sheaves on M, correspond to local system on M. This is the non-abelian Hodge correspondence. This is the spectral correspondence. It has a much more elementary nature to it. You're basically taking a sheaf in the cotangent bundle and pushing it forward, and there's a natural Higgs field on that. The point is that the abelianized Hecke acts here. The honest Hecke acts here and also here. the functionality of non-abelian Hodge correspondence accounts for the fact that if you have a Hecke eigen object on this side, it will be a Hecke eigen object on that side. Like I said, the pullback part is fine. It's the direct image that you need to work out carefully. This correspondence is elementary, but somehow that's the point of the whole thing. So the compatibility with spectral covers, with spectral construction, basically says, let me not do that here. Well, you need a lemma that says that H tilde, the abelianized Hecke operator, has another interpretation. The interpretation I gave was not quite geometric. It was, you need to think about the interpretation of these things as Higgs fields, and something has to commute and be preserved. But I'm saying there's a purely geometric way to describe it as an object, as a subvariety of M tilde cross M tilde. The claim is that this is the conormal bundle to H inside, T star M cross T star M. And M tilde is basically T star M. And I'm saying this abelianized thing is just a conormal direction. And the more general compatibility that you have says something like the action of the conormal to something on spectral data is tautologically equivalent to the action of H on the Higgs on Higgs sheets. So this is a calculation with Kozul cohomology. I can show it to you, but I am running out of time. So here what you... The point is that the cohomology of a Higgs bundle on some X, by definition, that is the hypercohomology of a complex on X, which looks like E goes by theta to E tensor omega 1, goes by theta to E tensor omega 2, and so on. But this complex is exact where theta is injective. So this, the cohomology of this complex is supported where theta is somehow tangent to the fibers. Let me just abbreviate that as on directions in which theta vanishes. So there's a subvariety x0 inside x defined by theta. The same thing comes up in various physics constructions. It's called the matter curve. You have a similar situation where you're trying to compute the spectrum of something and it all passes to just some small locus where some field vanishes. And if you work out where this locus is, that it just gives you the zeros of the conormal bundle. So let me not say more about that. There is one thing that I do need to say, which is the key point, which is why I left space down here. I don't have any of these objects. I do have a sheaf on M tilde, but it is not finite over M. So if you have sheaves that are quasi-finite, and I'm going to show you that the last thing I want to do is to show you that the sheaves we're getting are quasi-finite, not finite. They are missing some small locus exactly because of the difference between Higgs and the cotangent bundle. So if here you replace finite by quasi-finite, there still is a spectral construction, but instead of giving you Higgs sheaves, it gives you certain meromorphic Higgs sheaves. The problem is that these meromorphic Hicks-sheaves do not give you any local system. These meromorphic Hicks-sheaves do come with a filtration. You have along the divisor, the divisors where things blow up, you have a certain subsheaf which is compatible with the Higgs field. So there are many ways of assigning the weights, the jumps, to these things and creating parabolic Higgs sheaves. If you, we still, I'm claiming that this compatibility still works. So the object that Tony and I construct that is an eigenobject of the abelianized Hecke, it is quasi-finite. It gives a meromorphic Higgs on Bunn. There are many ways which transforms correctly under H as a meromorphic Higgs. There are many ways of choosing a parabolic structure on it, and all of them will transform correctly. Among those, there are ones for which C1 equals C2 equals 0. That's going to be some small subset in here. But as long as you know that this thing is surjective, that means that your meromorphic Hicks-sheave can be equipped with a parabolic structure that so that Mochizuki's result apply, and then this is going to be equivalent to a parabolic D-module or parabolic local system that blows up to a D-module. So this is the picture that we are following. Very similar conclusions, of course, have been obtained by Ed and Anton and Sergei. The physicists working from what seems like a completely different approach, they interpret the geometric Langlands conjecture in quantum field theory as a mirror symmetry between A brains and B brains, and they reach the same conclusion that the abelianized geometric Langlands is a classical limit, but it's also, in a sense, equivalent to the full geometric Langlands via this non-abelian Hodge theory. So let me just tell you where the real issue, where the real difficulty is, or the real issue. If I may just take a couple more minutes. So the problem is that Higgs contains T star Bunn, but is not equal to it. In other words, there exists unstable bundles V and some Higgs field theta such that V together with theta is stable. It's a good point of Higgs. So let's call those unstable points. So you have the map from Higgs to Bunn is not defined at those points. Or if you want to stick a fibre of the Hitchin map, a prim variety, in here, and again, the map is ill-defined at those points. So you need to blow these up, get P tilde, which does map to Bunn, and the question is, what's the image? So a theorem is that this image is, well, it's going to consist of stable bundles, but which ones? Non-very stable bundles. What's very stable? Well, inside T star Bunn, you have the nilpotent cone. What's a nilpotent cone? It's a set of Higgs fields which are nilpotent. Take its projection to Bunn. This is a cone. It's a Lagrangian cone. So it's the union of a various strata, Si, of conormal to these strata. One of these strata is the zero section, and then there are various other strata that are not, that don't dominate the base. the image here, the union of those I's that are not the zero section of SI, that is the locus of bundles that admit a non-zero nilpotent Higgs field. The complement of these are the very stables. So the union of these are the non-very stable. And since that's kind of an awkward term, non-very stable, I prefer to call it wobbly. Stable, but not very stable. So so the key is you need the wobbly locus, the wobblies, to be a normal crossing divisor. You need the Plimo-Chizuki's result. Then this is going to be the locus where everything blows up. So another result is that the Higgs fields that you get on the Milrovic Higgs fields blow up exactly along the wobbly locus, not along the branch locus, not anywhere else. You need to check that it's a normal crossing divisor. You need to check this local abelian property. And the main thing is you need to check the parabolic Chern classes finish. So can I have one more minute? Thank you. So we've been working with SL2 and various subcases of that. Let me just show you the answer in one case. Let's shift to something that I didn't actually talk about, which is the ramified Langlands. So, well, there's Langlands where the curve has some branch point, never mind what it is. But if you take P1 was 5 points, that's somehow the first case where your moduli space is not a curve but a surface. So both conditions on both Chern classes are non-trivial to impose. So we wanted to check that as a test case. We get that the moduli space bun depends on the weights you choose. So there's a GIT issue where you have a family of these things, where if the weights are small, I think smaller than 0.4 or something like that, you get that the moduli space bun is a DP4. It's a Del Pezzo surface where you blow up 4 points in general position in the plane. When the weight is between 0.4 and some higher number, I think it's 0.6, something like that, this thing blows up, bun becomes a DP5. You blow up one more point. I can tell you what the wobbly locus is. The wobbly locus in the DP4 is going to be, okay, so what's a DP4? We have, well, it's something that has 10 lines on it, and it has 5 rulings. The rulings are P1 vibrations. There's one point here. You take the 5 lines, one from each ruling, passing through that point, and you take the 10 actual lines on the surface. Those 15 lines turn out to be the wobbly locus. Does that have normal crossing? Well, it does, except at this one point. Bummer. We're stuck. Well, not quite. You change your linearization, your GIT linearization, you come up with a DP5. You're blowing up one more point in the DP4. Which point it is, of course, it's just that point. You're getting a DP5, and now the DP5 has 16 lines. One of them is the blow-up of this point. The other 15 are the wobbly locus. So you have a very clean picture of what it all looks like. So we've just worked out the whole geometry there, and indeed there is one natural choices of the weights that we put on these bundles, which gives us the first Chern class vanishes, and rather satisfyingly, we can get C2 to vanish as well at the same point. So we have a normal crossing divisor, and the behavior is locally abelian, and we have the vanishing Chern class. So at least in this case, we have what we believe is a rigorous proof of that the non-abelian Hodge approach constructs automorphic sheaves on Bun. I think we're close to doing SL2 in general. P1 was more with any number of points or any genus curve. Beyond that, it's a work in progress. So, thank you. That's why we avoided it.
But when you say that you construct a certain amount of sheaves, do you mean that an entire set by the sheaves or a world of stable bundles?
We are working with the moduli space of stable bundles. We choose a linearization at which there are no semi-stable bundles. All bundles are stable. So you get a compact, smooth moduli space of stable bundles. We just work on that. That's right.
So here you are constructing
That's right. That's what you construct. Hopefully, by the time we write it down, if you have the right object on the moduli space, presumably, its middle extension is. To the stack, it has the same property.
How do you check the complicated property, which is something that you can go to the applied for stable components?
That's right.
So that's if you only know the sheet on the stable locus, how do you check the
stable? Right. So in this setup, all bundles are stable. So I can write Heke. We have a compact moduli space of stable bundles. In this moduli space. All bundles in my moduli space are stable. And I can write Heke as a subvariety of the product of this thing with itself. So I have a purely projective version of everything. And then, presumably, this is dense in the stack, and the sheaves of the stack should be uniquely determined by this as the middle perversity extension of the objects we get. I think that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that Heke takes you to an unstable bundle, but that bundle has a stable equivalent. There's a point in the moduli space, which is the stabilization of that bundle. Yeah, Dima. P1 was 5 ramification points. Yes. In order to be able to use the classical limit result, we have to assume that the speckle cover is smooth. So it's a generic. We're saying it for generic monodromy, and I can probably in finite time produce the actual conditions that we need for it to qualify as generic. Yeah, I mean the condition is just that if you start with a local system on the curve, do the usual non-abelian Hodge that gives you a Higgs bundle, And therefore, a speckle cover, you just want that speckle cover to be smooth. That's my condition. It's a generic condition, but then you apply a diffeomorphism to it. So it's not quite an algebraic condition on the local system. You're excluding a thin set. That's all I can say. That's right. Because that's where we can prove the classical limit, or the abelianized version. Now, I keep saying abelianized and classical limit, and Tony keeps yelling at me that, yes, these things are equivalent, but it's very non-trivial, and you'll hear tomorrow the details of that equivalence. Is that a fair statement? Well, I've given you a lot to work on.
What is the weight here that you talk about, this weight between 0.4 and 0.6? It's not the weight.
No, this is the parabolic. This is the parabolic weight. So.
At which point? At five point at all?
No, I'm thinking the same at all points. Yeah. It's the same, it's all fine.